Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. You know, my heart is full tonight. It's a blessing for me to stand up here and for you to allow me to share the weekend with you. I can't tell you how much that means to me and what a great weekend it's been. As Scott just mentioned, what a great job all the speakers have done. Cindy, you did great too. Thank you so much. You know, I don't know. I tell you sincerely, I don't know how a guy like me gets here. You know, I don't have a particularly dramatic drunkalog. You won't be interested at all. I can prattle on for hours about it. Bill had asked if I could get you out of here by 9 o'clock so there's something he wanted to see on TV. I said, there is no way. But I will, just to give you hope, take a quick look at my watch now. And you know, I don't have a particularly even dramatic story in recovery. The circumstances, are not all that dramatic and intriguing. But I think the real gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the circumstances of my life, but the experience of my life from the inside out. That the life I'm living today, the world is a friendlier place to me today. And I'm much more comfortable with my place in the world today than I was before. So I hope to share a little bit about that tonight. I hope, if nothing else, by the time I'm done tonight, that you'll know that I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for what AA has done for me and for my family and the life that it's afforded me. And again, that life isn't about the circumstances, but it's about my experience of it. That experience in life on a spiritual level, not merely the physical level, not that three-dimensional life, but to add that fourth dimension. I'm very grateful for that, as is my wife and as is my daughter. I hope to share a little bit about them this evening. I called home this afternoon. I got both Connie and Abby. My daughter, Abby's 25. She's been living at home with us for about the last 8 or 9 months, And they were laughing. They answered the phone cackling. They were doing something. I said, what's going on, Ab? And she says, oh, Dad, she says, it's just another regular day here at the Lee household where nothing is regular. And I didn't dig any further. I don't think I wanted to know. You know, thanks so much for the invitation by the committee to be here. You guys have taken such good care of all of us that you invited to participate in the weekend with, and believe me, I appreciate it. Karen took, just talked with me for months before I got here. I think, Scott, it was well over a year ago when he issued the invitation, and I really appreciate that. And so again, thank you for letting me spend this weekend with you. What I know, you know, there are some of the guys and that I sponsor will ask me about these weekends, so I just want to tell you a few things so I don't forget them as we get started. One is, I know that I'm not here because I'm a special member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll tell you, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is special for me to be here, and I thank you for that privilege. I know that you don't necessarily need to hear what I have to say, but I got an overwhelming need to say it, because I just might burst if I didn't get the opportunity. And my home group's just about cut me off, so thank you. I know that I'll leave here tomorrow with more than I came with. I know that the experiences that I have are not from the podium here necessarily, but everything that I've gotten to do this weekend up until now and what I expect for the rest of the night and in the morning. And the people I've gotten a chance to talk to and to strike up a friendship with Michaeline, to get to hear Otto, to get to see John and Cindy again, my friend Sharon, my friend Evan today. I mean, that's special stuff for me, folks. I get to go someplace and spend time with substantive people. And folks like you out in the hallway and talking, as Scott said, that the real magic, I think the speakers just serve as a framework to allow the weekend to take place. And I know that the real things happen in between the meetings. And that's been true for me this weekend. Marianne asked me if I was nervous as we were getting ready for dinner. And I said, I'm really not awfully nervous. I don't get terribly nervous anymore, and I'll tell you why. It's because my sponsor a good while ago took away any, I'd spoken at a little group meeting in Richmond, Virginia years ago, and I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and I was I just got lost. You know, I stumbled and bumbled my way all through the evening, and I was driving home, and I got home, and I called Joe, and I said, Joe, I just don't think I did a very good job tonight. And he said, well, Steve, you're starting from a false premise, pal. He says, because that implies there's a night you think you did do a good job. And, and he said, by the way, it's not up to you to do a good job or a bad job, and it's certainly not up to you to try to determine which is which. He said, you simply have the privilege of going and doing what you were invited to do to the best of your ability on that given night. And that's what you're going to get tonight, what I've got. And I don't know what that's going to be till we get started here, you know. I got two or three stories I typically tell, and what happens in between, I'm just not sure. And he said, Steve, often the speaker meeting is for the speaker. And that you folks get a chance to listen patiently and tolerantly and give me a chance to say what I need to say. And I believe that sometimes I say from up here something I need to hear. I discover something about me I did not know when I started. It's not always something I wanted to know, by the way. Sometimes it's something that pushes me into further action. You know, my sponsor shared with me, he said, Steve, those times that you're going to be most uncomfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous is when your awareness is out ahead of your willingness. And that has happened to me. That's not an old problem. That's a current problem. As I continue to try, do I continue to be willing to grow along spiritual lines? Am I willing to stand in front of the man I am today? Am I willing to look at myself today and still try to grow? I hope so, but I know that I'm not here because I'm there. I'm here because you guys push me forward. I'm here because I know I'll go back determined to be a better AA member because of the people and experiences I've had this weekend. And God must know I need that to send me out every now and then just to send me back to the front lines of Alcoholics Anonymous and do what needs to be done at home and with the men I sponsor and in my family. So thank you for pushing me forward. A couple of years later, after that little meeting, I'd been invited by a friend of mine to speak at his anniversary at what was the big speaker meeting in Richmond, Virginia. And there were about 200 people. And I was nervous before that meeting and on a Sunday morning. And I said, Joe, I am nervous today. I said, this is far and away the largest crowd I've spoken before. And he said, Steve, don't worry, pal. He said, by the time you're done, it'll be down to the size you're used to. And and that could happen here tonight. But as the crowds have gotten larger, it takes the room longer to empty. So again, thanks for having me. I'll tell you, I've got a sobriety date. It's June 30th, 1989. And my home group is the backroom group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets every Saturday and Sunday morning. In Nashville, Tennessee, at 9 a.m. we have a literature study, and at 10:30 we have a discussion meeting with a topic from conference-approved literature. And I'll tell you, I've got a great home group. And I say that we have a great meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every Saturday and Sunday morning, but I think what makes us a great home group is the activity between meetings, the outreach, the enthusiasm of that group, the participation at treatment facilities and correctional facilities and sharing one with another and the fellowship and the stuff we do. I'm a very grateful member of that home group, and they mean a lot to me. I hope if you're in Nashville, you'll come see us sometime. I've invited Bill, who's coming down in a couple of weeks, and hope that'll happen for him. I told you I've got a sobriety date of June the 30th, so now I'm going to tell you what is typically the most embarrassing thing I share from the podium, and that's about June the 29th of 1989. And really, it wasn't a big deal. It's just I got to tell you about my last drink. And I've been here since Thursday night. I have seen a lot of alcoholics here. There are some bad alcoholics here. I mean, some of you are still wearing the scars of this alcoholism, and my last drink was an Amaretto on the rocks. Yeah, I'm properly embarrassed by that. I hope you now know that I did not know that was going to be my last drink when I took it, you know. I mean, they said, hey, Steve, we've had a little meeting, and you can have one more drink. What will it be? You know, Amaretto would not have made the top 10, but I'd have been sucking off the neck of a vodka bottle. But But the fact is, I was scheduled into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And I say scheduled, and not because I had had some epiphany and determined that I needed or wanted to stop drinking, or that I needed some moral uplift or my life needed some change. None of those things. I simply was going to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my 6 DUI. And June the 29th, my wife and I went out with three other couples to kind of have sort of a last hurrah before I was going to go away. We were then going to spend and did spend June the 30th with my then 5-year-old daughter, Abby, and before Daddy went away on a 28-day business trip. And I know some of you have been on that trip. And so we did that. We went out, and I capped the evening off with an Amarillo on the rocks. I smoked a joint. I went to bed, got up the next day, and we went. We took my daughter to Chuck E. Cheese, and it's a little public service announcement. If you haven't stopped drinking yet, don't spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, Otto, I know you went through some stuff over there in the jungles of Vietnam, but that was a hellish day at Chuck E. Cheese, and. Isn't it embarrassing? Amaretta, Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, I'm just the poster boy for middle-class alcoholism. And I think that's okay, you know. I think here's what I, you know, as I've listened to all our wonderful speakers this weekend, and what I know is that alcoholism comes in a lot of different packages. It looks different on different people. Alcohol affects different people differently, even alcoholics. And the message of alcoholics comes in different packages as well, but the message itself needs to remain constant. And I recognize that my alcoholism and Otto's alcoholism and anybody else who perhaps may describe him or herself as an alcoholic in here is alike. You know, our book talks about the fact that the classification of alcoholics is in many ways outside the scope of our book, and then it begins to classify a few. It talks about the psychopath. You know, I've seen three here this weekend. I won't point you out specifically. It talks about the manic depressive, who is perhaps the most puzzling. It talks about the guy who after not drinking for a while, thinks perhaps he can drink with impunity. And it talks about the guy who is like other people in every respect except the effect that alcohol has upon him. But it says that all these and many others, so there must be many others, have one thing in common, at least one thing, and that is the phenomenon of craving, the physical allergy of alcohol. That's where I plant my flag. I think that is the single thing. It is not the only thing, but it is the single thing that I seem to have in common with everyone who's an alcoholic in the way that Alcoholics Anonymous describes one. And I tend to think that the unmanageability, the second part of step one, is common to the alcoholic, but not necessarily exclusive to the alcoholic. Seems like there are over 200 other 12-step programs who use unmanageability as a part of that first step. But the thing is, that single thing that we all have in common, that allergy to alcohol, is the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't treat. I'm as allergic to alcohol today, I believe, as I have ever been. In fact, it is quite likely, should I take a drink today, that my reaction to that allergy might be more pronounced than it was the last time I had a drink. I'm not sure. I don't want to test it. I've seen it in some others. It's a theory I don't want to test myself. So I know that even though as we sit around and we share our stories with each other, and we all have stories. And so what the book tells me is that in working with others, it says we tell the new guy exactly what happened to us. And that means I don't need to run from anything I've done, nor do I need to make something up that I haven't done. The only thing I have of real value that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous is the truth about me. So I'm going to endeavor to tell you the truth about me. I'm going to be honest with you tonight. I don't have the same commitment to accuracy. Sometimes I'm honestly mistaken. Sometimes the way I see things is not exactly how they happened. And what I've discovered over time is even the what I was like part of my story begins to change because I begin to see things differently. I get a clearer picture. That new pair of glasses that Chuck Chamberlain talked about allows me to see things, not things that weren't there, but things that I could not see before. This prescription seems to get dialed in over time, and I begin to see things as they really are. And sometimes that's uncomfortable, but at the end of the day, if I can see things as they really are, then I can begin to approach my problem and address or embrace the solution of that problem in a meaningful way. Before I go on, I want to mention my wife again. I told you that that I was getting ready to head off on July 1st of 1989 to this treatment facility. I got the kind of support from Connie that a lot of people don't get. As she followed me out to the front porch and my friend Ricky came by to pick me up to drive me off to this treatment facility, Connie's last words were, "No matter what, honey, don't stop drinking. No matter what, don't let them talk you into stopping drinking." And, you know, her sobriety date's 10 days after mine, and and I will tell you unapologetically, it's a real important 10 days to me, and I lord it over her regularly, and anytime we have an argument or disagreement or see something differently, I say, "Just wait 10 days, baby, it'll come to you." And, I mean, she hates that, I have to tell you. It's become kind of a running joke, though, but I came in a few years ago from a conference on a, you know, late on a Sunday night, and I was easing into bed, and you know, she rolled over to greet me, and she said, "You didn't tell them that 10-day thing, did you?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, baby, they love it. I got to tell them." And she says, "I just hate that." And I said, "I know, but in 10 days you won't." And I want to tell you with all sincerity that, you know, that I aspire to be the member of Alcoholics Anonymous that my wife is. And we're both so grateful for the relationship that we have today and the life we have today. And we know that it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because that we have embraced what you have offered us. You know, it took us a while. We went through some difficult times after getting sober because it took us a while. A marriage can be kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous in that what brings us together won't necessarily keep us together. You know, my wife and I met in a bar. We met over about an hour after that over a mound of cocaine. It was love at first sight. We spent some time together. We went down to Mexico on a vacation. We drank something out of a coconut. We got on a boat, went out to international waters where an Austrian captain read the wedding ceremony in Spanish. And some people thought that, you know, that wouldn't take. And we're in our 27th year of being married, we celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary last December 31st, New Year's Eve, and I was speaking somewhere, and I said, "We had just celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary," and people kindly applauded, as you did. And I said, "Look," I said, "we you know, that we celebrated our 26. You know, we didn't celebrate them all." And and there's some that we endured, you know, and there's some that we tolerated, and there's some we found our way through. But we're both so grateful that we held in there for you to change us, for you to help us find each other again, because what brought us together would not keep us together. And we knew that we loved each other, but we weren't sure if we liked each other. We weren't sure if we were compatible. You don't have to be bad people not to be compatible. But today she is truly my partner in life. And, you know, she's glad I'm here and glad that I'm with you and glad that I'm enjoying myself. See, she doesn't. There was a time in our marriage, I don't know about some of you guys, where if one of us had fun without the other one, that was somehow disloyal to the relationship, you know. And it was sort of like, don't have fun without me and I won't allow you to have any fun with me. So, And today what we both want for each other is to nurture those things that enrich our lives. And they're not always the same thing. We have some very divergent interests, and we encourage each other to do those things that feed our spirit. And I'm grateful for that. My buddy Ricky came by and he picked me up that July the first morning. What had happened is a year before I had left an establishment in Brentwood, Tennessee. I was living not in Brentwood then, I was in Antioch, Tennessee, just about 10 miles from there. These are all the suburbs of Nashville. I'd left a bar. I'd gotten on the little side street going the wrong way. I had hit a Brentwood police officer, and I came to in the Williamson County Jail the next morning. I call Connie. It's not the first time I'd call Connie from jail. It's the first time she had encouraged me to call someone else. I did. A guy came and picked me up. Finally, I went and to the impound to get my car. That's the first that I realized it had been wrecked. I'd blacked out, and I was a regular blackout drinker. I didn't remember everything that had happened. By that afternoon, I was in a lawyer's office there in Franklin, Tennessee, and who my Nashville, Tennessee lawyer had recommended to me because we were trying at the same time a DUI case in Nashville. And he had become a little bit just tired of me, I think, just tired of that of guys like me. And this was the second or third time that he had represented me, and he encouraged me to get a lawyer there, a more local lawyer in Williamson County. I'm sitting in that lawyer's office about 2 or 3 that afternoon, and he asked me a question that I don't remember being asked before. It may have been, but I don't recall. And he just said, "Steve, do you think you've got a problem with alcohol?" He was looking at the arrest report. He was looking at the accident report. And I said, "I tell you what, pal," I said, "I believe I got a legal problem, and I wish you would focus all your time and attention on this legal dilemma that I have." And he said, "Okay, that's what I'll do." And he did, and what happened later was they gave me, they were going to give me 60 days in jail. And I got to tell you, I was scared to death to go to jail. I mean, again, I'm just not a tough guy. I don't think I had the skill sets for jail. And it scared me to death. They're going to give me 60 days in jail. They finally said, "Look," they in the plea bargain said, "or you can do 10 weekends in jail and go to residential treatment for drug and alcohol rehabilitation." Kind of a form. I'd heard that before, but I knew nothing about it really, and I knew nothing about AA. It was really a math problem. That even my math said that 10 weekends and 28 days is 48 days versus 60 days in jail. Neither one seemed to hold any appeal over the other to me, so I chose the weekends and treatment. My buddy Ricky's driving me over to this treatment facility on a Saturday morning, July the 1st of 1989, and I had no idea what lie in front of me. He said, "Steve, what do you think this deal's going to be like, man?" I said, "Rick, I don't have a clue, man." I said, "But I'll tell you one thing." I said, "I'm not going to get in some little circle and go, 'I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic,' and just whine about the most intimate details of my life." I said, about 3 weeks later, I was just telling people way more than they wanted to know about me. And at that time, I did. I was just making stuff up, too, because I wanted some AA street cred right away. You know, I didn't tell that Amaretta story. You know, that wasn't my treatment story, okay? Ricky pulled me up there. I got out, and I had a host of emotions. You know, I was angry to have to go. I was afraid. I had anxiety. I couldn't really have labeled all those emotions at the time, but I was just torn in many different directions, and I had no clue what to expect. I got there, and they administered what seemed like a test right away. And some of you guys have taken a version of this. They call it an assessment. We've got our own pamphlet with questions in AA. But they are, frankly, impossible. It's an impossible test to pass. I'm pretty sure nobody, none of the alcoholics in this room, passed the test. But it was full of questions that started with the words, "Have you ever?" And it said, "Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever had a problem at work because of drinking? Have you ever had a problem at home because of drinking?" 30 "have you ever" questions. And they went on to explain that, by the way, Steve, "have you ever" means even once, even with a really good reason. And then you guys know that they just have check yes or check no to what are clearly essay questions. They require some explanation. You can't just check yet. I got to give you some background on this. And, you know, I want to tell you, we're going to laugh tonight. I hope we have a good time. You know, my friend Scott says that laughter is the sound effect of recovery. And I hope we have a good time. But if you're new, I hope you don't think I thought that was funny that morning. I want to tell you that I could not make myself check that box. That I couldn't, what the conclusions that people were going to draw about me in my mind as a result of me checking this box. I needed to explain myself. You know, back in the back of the book in the story Freedom from Bondage, she talks about the fact and gives a explanation or definition of rationalization, saying it's providing a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior. And I realize how much of my life I spent trying to provide an acceptable explanation for those things that are clearly unacceptable. And for years, I was trying to explain myself to the people around me. But over time and toward the end, it became necessary for me to explain me to me, to give myself an explanation for what I had done that would allow me to be able to live with me, becoming the man that I had become. That morning, it was certainly necessary for me to try to explain myself. You know, I had questions about the questions. You know, have you ever drank alone? Oh, yeah, but they left. And, have you ever drank in the morning? What do you mean morning? And, you know, I mean, because like it's 12:01 a.m. the morning. If I'm up a little late drinking, you're going to think I'm a morning drinker. And you're going to think I'm like the guy that's got to reach over and grab that half pint to get his, you know, blood pumping in the morning. I worried about all of the answers to these questions. You know, I ended up, it said if you answer yes to three or four of them, you're a problem drinker. Five, you're alcoholic. Six, you're chronic alcoholic. You know, I didn't know what chronic alcoholic was, but it did sound like a promotion from regular alcoholic. And, I answered yes to 10 of the questions. You know, I got my whole treatment file some years later. I lied on a bunch of other questions. I misunderstood several of the questions. I said, only one I know for certain and for sure I answered honestly is I never drank while pregnant. And, you know, not even once and not even with a really good reason. And so that's where I landed on July the 1st. I'm going to go back and tell you a little bit about how I got there. And, you know, I'm going to try to do what I'm supposed to do, tell you what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. I just don't promise to do it in any particular order. And I'm sort of like a Quentin Tarantino movie, you know. There's just no time and space continuum. And if I think of something to say, I got to say it right now. I'm just going to tell a whole host of seemingly unrelated stories that I hope come together by the end of the hour. But I never know. I grew up in Smyrna, Tennessee. Smyrna's a small town outside of Nashville, about 30 miles. I was a good kid. I came from a good family. I mean, again, you know, Otto's life experience and my life experience could not be more different. And this room is full of people who have different life experiences. So circumstances don't seem to cause alcoholism. Bad ones don't seem to cause it. Good ones don't seem to prevent it. I can understand how challenging circumstances might drive someone to seek relief a little sooner than others. But I was a good kid, middle-class family, older sister, older brother, younger sister. You know, yesterday was my older sister's birthday. I got to tell you, a year ago, I went to her 60th birthday party and in Memphis where she lives, and there were a lot of people there I don't know. And during the course of the evening, somebody would introduce themselves to me or I'd introduce myself to them, and they'd go, "Oh, you're Stephen. You're Linda's brother." I go, "Yeah." She said, "Oh," she says, that you help so many people, that you go all over the country and do this and do that. Now, I want to tell you real quickly, last November, my daughter and I were riding down to listen to somebody, a friend of ours, sing and perform in Nashville. And earlier in the day, someone in my family had suggested that I probably spend a little too much time in AA and that probably wasn't necessary. And I was telling my daughter that. And she says, he said, "You know, I don't think you need to do that to stay sober." And I was kind of just talking with my daughter about that. And she said, "You know, Dad, you and Mom do more than stay sober. You help people." And I want you to know I'm not confused about that level of help. What the point that I wanted to make is to go over there where my sister's friends were and know that she looks at me as a person that's helpful to other people. To be in the car with my daughter and know that she perceives her mother and I as people that live purposeful lives. You know, that's what a reward that was. I'm not saying that we deserve the moniker, but it certainly warmed my heart that that's the way she felt about us. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm growing up there in Smyrna, a middle-class family. Nobody's knocking anybody around. Nobody's doing anything. It's kind of a leave-it-to-beaver type existence. I got no reason to be an alcoholic. And the truth is, I'm a good kid. In fact, what I was a compliant kid. I went where I said I was going to go. I came home when I said I was going to come home. I was with who I said I was going to be with while I was gone. I had made a decision that I wasn't going to be a drinker. I had a code of morals and a philosophy of living. You know, that our book talks about, and it says if a code of morals and philosophy of living were sufficient, many of us would have recovered long ago. And I'll tell you that my code and my morals were sufficient. Right up to the moment, they were no longer sufficient. And I don't know that we know, maybe that's the progression of alcoholism, and I don't know when that happened, but I do know that when I was a freshman in college at Middle Tennessee State University, two friends of mine came by, and we were going to go back to my high school to a basketball game. I climbed into the back seat of a canary yellow 1968 Volkswagen Bug. They handed back a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine, and I was glad. I heard somebody else today started on the Boone's Farm. Sometimes I get a groan with that, and it really bothers me. AA is a fascinating place to me because, you know, we'll brag about holding up 7-Elevens and doing stuff, but, ooh, I didn't drink the Boone's Farm. And but they handed back that bottle of Strawberry Hill, and, you know, and I took my drink, and it went around two or three times, and the experience that I had was all of a sudden I couldn't wait to get where we were going. And I thought that you couldn't wait to see me when I got there. And I don't think, you know, that's truly, I couldn't wait to, you know, the back seat of that Volkswagen would no longer hold me. I wanted to spring myself on an unsuspecting world, and I never felt so comfortable with me. And it was a tremendous and wonderful experience. I blacked out that night. I don't remember everything about it. Nothing terrible happened. I don't know if I was alcoholic just before I took that drink. And I don't know if I was alcoholic right after I took that drink. And I don't know at what point I became alcoholic. I don't enter into the debate. So I don't know if I drank alcoholically from that moment on, because I know I drank enthusiastically from that moment on. And, you know, our book talks about the fact that that those guys say that while they can't prove it, they believe that many of them could have stopped drinking early in their drinking career. And I believe, like me, they couldn't prove it because they never tried it. I didn't try to stop drinking. Lack of power doesn't seem to be a problem for me until I want to try to do something differently. I don't recognize that there's a lack of power until I try to exert some power. That powerlessness doesn't seem to show itself until I can't do that thing which I've decided I want or need to do. And at that point, there was no need to try to regulate my drinking. I could not wait for the next opportunity. I began to have consequences from my drinking right away. They were, you know, I had lots of car wrecks. I got to tell you, Sharon and I were talking last night. I'm going to share a couple of driving and drinking stories because that's what I did. But, you know, I've looked and read the papers and looked at television the last couple of days and the tragedy of that Angels pitcher and his companions. And boy, I hope nobody here, there's a room like this of people that, of alcoholics and our friends and loved ones and Al-Anons, we don't have a gathering like this that somebody's lives haven't been turned totally upside down and devastated by a drunk driver just like me. So while my heart went out for the people that were killed, that were injured, and their families, I want you to know that I sympathize for them. I empathize with the driver of the other car. I understand who that guy is. That guy is me. That guy is me. And so I hope that you don't think that I take lightly the things that I did in an automobile. But the reason that we can have some fun, as I said earlier today, is because I'm on this side of those things today. None of these things were funny when they were happening. But In fact, I'm going to tell two quick drinking stories and go on and sober up. I hope these will convince you that I'm a drunk, and then I want to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and my experience in it. I ran away. I began drinking like that right away and having some little car accidents. And you know, we have the circumstantial chaos of our drinking. I think the bigger toll on me was taken in that gradual sacrifice of my self-respect and my integrity and the person that I was, and not being the father I wanted and needed to be, not being the husband, betraying the trust of those people I loved the most, doing that thing I said I would never do, and then doing it again and then doing it again, and meaning with all my heart each time that I would not do it. But these little car wrecks and things began to happen. I'd had a couple of DUIs. I ran off to Fort Lauderdale when I was 23, kind of running away from home. My father had died when I was a freshman in college. My brother had kind of taken over our family business, and I went to work for him when I was 21. And I just couldn't do it. I just was too immature. I was too lazy. In fact, nobody was telling me I was alcoholic. They were saying, "Steve, grow up, be a man. It's time to show up for life." And I just couldn't seem to be able to do it, and I couldn't explain why I couldn't do it. I was afraid of everything, but I couldn't dare tell people about the fear that I had. I couldn't explain the fear I had. But I ran off down to Florida, and these folks, unfamiliar with my drinking history, gave me a company car. And I was over at somebody's house one night. We were watching Monday Night Football. We were drinking heavily and accessorizing that with a variety of other things. And I got in the car to leave at halftime of that game, and I'm flying down this little residential street. And there was a horseshoe turn that I just didn't navigate. And I drove this car into a tree, and man, it just caved in the whole passenger side of this car, broke out the front windshield, the back windshield, the hood was caved in. But miraculously, I wasn't badly hurt. I was shaken, but not badly hurt. I just thought quickly, I cannot stay here. I cannot let the police show up and get another DUI, and I'm going to lose this job, and there'll be consequences to pay. And so I shoved the car into reverse, and remarkably, it would drive. I backed it away from the tree, and I tried to get back over. My goal was to get back to my friend's house where we would, come up with a plan. And I'm driving back over there. The car's driving almost sideways. The frame is bent so badly. The glass is blowing in, that shattered glass is blowing in on me. People are looking, and I'm just, God, please let me get over there. It's shaking and just easing. And finally I get there and I walk inside, and Larry, Curly, and Mo put this plan together. The plan we came up with was that we'd drink a couple of cups of coffee. These guys would get in the car with me. We would drive the car back over there and drive it back into the tree. Now stay with me, because it's a good plan, but they would then serve as witnesses and corroborate my story that I had been run off the road, probably by a drunken driver. And we go back over there. We ease the car into the tree. I get out. I'm walking up to the house at the corner lot. Certainly there were no cell phones or anything. I'm going to go, knock on the door and borrow this guy's phone and call the police. As I'm walking up there, he comes flying out the side door to his house. He's running down there where we are. His eyes are as big as saucers. He has grave concern on his face. And he said, "Are you guys okay? Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, man, we're okay." And he said, "Well, it's the damnedest thing." He said, "You're the second guy to hit that tree tonight." I said, "Yeah, man, you ought to cut that damn tree down." We call the police. The police come. You guys, I don't have to explain to this crowd that when we tell a lie, we give layers of detail. So we talked about the white Ford pickup truck that had run me off the road. We gave a partial license plate number and a description of the driver. A few days later, I'm getting a little resentment that they hadn't solved this case. Usually, you give them that kind of information, they're bringing somebody in, Now, you flash forward a year or two later, and I'm living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was at a TGI Fridays one afternoon. I'm throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking Tylenols, I leave there. I'm disoriented. I get on the interstate I-285, the perimeter there in Atlanta. I get on it going east in the westbound lane. I hit a car head on, and two other cars hit us. It totaled all four cars. I came to in the Fulton County Jail. I had urinated on myself, and I'd vomited on myself. Or, you know, if I say I hope I did, because somebody did. And some of you know if you go down in the drunk tank, the stains you wake up with may or may not be of your own making. But it's an indignity I prefer to think I inflicted on myself. But the truth of the matter is that as I came to that morning, I had never been more ashamed of what I had done and the harm that I'd caused other people. And I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries. Some people had been sent to the hospital. As it turns out, they weren't badly hurt. I did get sued over that. But I was as ashamed as I'd been in my life for that. I was as humiliated as I'd ever been, the state that I found myself in. I was as afraid as I had ever been of the consequences that awaited me, both legally and personally and professionally. And I was as certain as I'd ever been that I'd never drink again. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking, you know, I nearly overreacted to that. And see, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I saw in the big book where it says that there'll come a time that a guy like me won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, I'll be without defense against the drink. When I saw things like that in our book, I said, man, that's it. You know, I'm going to speak a little bit about the big book tonight during the course of my talk, and not because I think you haven't read it or you need me to explain it to you, but because the book Alcoholics Anonymous is where I found both my problem and my solution. It's when I read those things and when folks like you shared with me and when I would read it in the book, when all of a sudden you articulated for me that thing which I couldn't get my arms around myself. When I read that, I knew that's what had happened to me time and time again. When I read later in the book, when it talks about the fact that that the alcoholic, more than most, wears two faces, that he's the actor, and it's a stage character that he wants his fellows to see, and he wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. I knew that that's the way I had lived my life, all my life, that I craved and needed you to tell me how I was doing, but even when you said nice things to me about me, it rang hollow because I knew you were responding to the fraud, to the actor. Even that didn't resonate with me. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to understand not just my drinking problem, not just that I found people who drank like I drank, but people who felt like I felt. Because the big mystery to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't that people like you drank and things happened, as our book says. When the alcoholic drinks, something happens. But what surprised me and what I couldn't explain about myself was why on a Tuesday afternoon with a job, with a wife, with a daughter, with people who loved me, people who I loved, why did my life feel so empty? Why was it so unfulfilling? Why did I feel so detached from the rest of the world? And why didn't I really connect with the human race? Why was I so lonely? Lonely is not the word I put on it. Lonely is the word I know today. I was isolated, and that isolation wasn't being isolated. It wasn't lack of proximity to people. It was that I felt no connection to people. My feelings were so walled off, and I had no explanation for that, and I certainly didn't connect it to my drinking. You know, my drinking just went on like that, and I just did a host of, like many of us, tacky, tawdry things. You know, the book says that our escapades will be variously, you know, comic, pitiful, and tragic. And I was pitiful a lot. I was the dancing bear. I was the guy that had to drink to go drinking. I was a guy that thought that he had to carry the load at any party that he went to or any gathering. I was the guy that, when that was over, would go get in my car and be empty. Absolutely empty. At any rate, I'm in that treatment center now. They've dropped me off. I've taken my assessment. I have failed the test. Here's what it felt like was going on at treatment. And I want to tell you that I had a wonderful treatment experience, and I'm so grateful for having been there. But it seemed like I had been charged with the crime of alcoholism, and that they were trying to present, actually put me on the witness stand, ask me questions, and prosecute me for that charge. They would ask me questions about me. They would ask me questions about my drinking. They would ask me questions about my behavior. And with my answers, they would begin to say, "See, Steve, see." Now, I'm defending myself from these charges as vigorously as I can. When they are talking to me, I'm thinking about my response. I'm not willing to be alcoholic. I do not want to be alcoholic. About the second day there, a guy said, "Steve, I think you're manic depressive." You know, heck, I got excited. I said, I don't want to be an alcoholic. I might be willing to be manic depressive. And then we decided I wasn't manic depressive. And then a guy said, "Well, I think you're passive aggressive." Now I'm real excited. I'll bite on this passive aggressive thing. I said, "Well, what do you mean passive aggressive? What is that?" And he said, "Steve, you know, it just means that you don't like the way things are most of the time, but you're too big a chicken shit to do anything about it." And you know, I realized I'd lived so much of my life that way. I'd lived so much of my life in a state of disappointment, quiet disappointment, wishing things were different, wishing you understood, wishing you treated me differently. Not complaining, continuing to be compliant, but disappointed. The third night there, two men from Alcoholics Anonymous came in, and they did what I believe our book suggests we do. They came in as ex-problem drinkers in whom the problem had been solved, properly armed with the facts about themselves. They did, you know, they weren't on an AA membership drive. They weren't trying to talk me into anything. They didn't ask me anything about me. What they did was shared openly about themselves, about their alcoholism, about their recovery. And they allowed me to listen as they did everybody else. And, you know, nothing, I used to say nothing big happened that night, but what happened was almost imperceptible to me. When they left, you know, I didn't take the AA altar call, you know, and go, "Let go and let God, I'm in," you know. I was just glad they had come. I said, I felt better for them having been there. And what I know looking back is that they were speaking the language of the heart. They shared some important information with me that night, but I believe it wasn't an intellectual thing that happened. I believe that they didn't aim the message at my head, that it hit me in the heart. It was that message of weight and depth that Scott talked about. It was a message when properly armed at the alcoholic can hardly miss its mark. It certainly didn't with me. And it wasn't information. It was a feeling. It was perhaps the language of the heart, and that's where it hit me. About 3 weeks into that treatment experience, I got excited. I decided that I was alcoholic. I still didn't quite know what that meant, but I was excited about the prospect of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had decided to stop drinking, and I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know about you, but I thought there was going to be an awful lot of not drinking in AA. You know, when folks ask me, "Steve, we're going to go to the Titans game Sunday. You want to go?" "Boys, I'd love to, but I'll be home not drinking." "And we're going to go on a little golf outing. Would you like to join us?" "Boys, I'll not be drinking all weekend long. I'll just be home not drinking." And I was prepared to do that. I really thought that a life in Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be a life of self-sacrifice. And I was prepared to give that my best shot, but what you folks know, that is not what Alcoholics Anonymous is. When our book asks, do we have a substitute? Boy, do we have a substitute. It is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, where my imagination is fired, where I get released from care, boredom, and worry, where life takes on new meaning, where the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead. That's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for it. I popped out of that treatment facility and I went down to a clubhouse in Nashville called the 202 Club, the Friendship House. I went upstairs and any of two or three meetings might be going on at one time, and I turned to my left and went into a small room with 12 or 13 people, and they are people that changed my life. I am so grateful. I wandered into a big book study. And you know, if I'd wandered into an open discussion meeting, and I love open discussion meetings, primarily because I can't wait to hear what I have to say in one. And that is often the problem. You know, my sponsor, Frank, who I met in that room that day, the folks in that room downstairs at the half measures table, they referred to them as big book thumpers, and it wasn't a term of endearment to them. But those folks didn't thump me with that book. What they did was introduce me to the message of recovery that's contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had a respect and they had a reverence for the literature of AA. And they just introduced me to it and helped me find myself in it. I met my sponsor, Frank, in there. And Frank said, Steve, you want to spend some time in our literature, so when you go to those open discussion meetings, you will know whether what you're hearing is Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you want some misinformation about AA, just attend a few of our meetings. And see, sometimes I'm the source of that misinformation. I don't mean to be. I don't think anybody means to be. But I hope no one depends on me to be their source, their single source for the message of recovery in AA. So he encouraged me to take a look at that book and spend time. I asked him if he'd sponsor me. He took me back into another little room there. And he spent about the next 15 minutes, it seemed like, saying yes, and then telling me what he was not going to do. He said, I ain't going to be your marriage counselor. I ain't going to be your banker. I'm not a taxi driver. And I said, you know, Frank, this is exciting for me. He told me all the things that he wasn't going to do. Then over time in Alcoholics Anonymous, what he meant was that he wasn't going to solve any of those problems. But what he did do was help me apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life to address any problem that showed up. You know, the thing that I've learned among many things in AA, the experience that I've had, is my problems aren't what I thought they were. You know, my problem's hardly ever my problem. My problem is my problem with my problem. You know, I'm broke. I think lack of money is my problem. My problem is learning to live a life that is happily and usefully effective in spite of the fact that I'm broke. If my daughter, my wife, are not treating me appropriately, I think they're my problem. My problem is, how can I be okay in spite of that? It is my resistance to surrender that is typically my problem. You know, some of you may have noticed, especially, you know, Walt told me that, he said, Steve, the camera will put on 10 pounds. I didn't know it was all going to be on my head. Some of you may have noticed that I'm bald. My daughter came in about 10, 11 years ago, and I still had some hair, and I had so few of them I had named them all and given them all a responsibility, but I was spreading it around a little bit trying to get maximum coverage and experimenting a little, and she just said, Dad, she said, when you're bald, are you just going to be crazy? And I said, no, baby, but this going bald is driving me crazy, and the being bald has been easy. The going bald was hard. The resistance to that, to have something happening to me that I said cannot happen. At 10 years sober, Connie and I had to file for bankruptcy. That didn't happen overnight. It took a few years to go broke, you know? And most of it was irresponsibility on my part in sobriety. And you know, the pressure ratchets up in the home a little bit when the money gets tight sometimes. And we began to argue a little bit, and we were resisting this. And finally, one day we had a conversation. We'd had a fight. We'd said things you can't pretend you didn't say. And finally, we talked about this, and we said, you know what, this is hard. But what's hard is you and I, our friction over this hard. If we can do this together, then we can do it. And we became partners that day, and our resistance when going broke was the thing I was most afraid of and the thing I decided can't be happening, then I had to live a fearful life every day. But when we said, sure, it can happen, you know, the problem with our problem. One of the things, I moved to Richmond, Virginia at a year sober, and I got a sponsor over there, a guy named Joe S. And Joe, if Frank introduced me as he did to the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, and gave me a respect for that, Joe really showed me the application of AA and the third legacy of AA in terms of service. And as we went through some things in the book, I was looking at how it works, where it said some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. I think Nancy mentioned those old ideas today. And I said, Joe, this bothers me. I said, this seems to imply that all my old ideas are bad ideas. I said, and I showed up at AA with some damn good ideas. And he said, Steve, I'm sure you did, pal. He said, really? I believe you did. He said, no, I hadn't heard any of them yet, but he said, I'm sure you did. He said, but that's not what it means. He says, what it means is, Steve, are you willing to set down all these ideas? because you might be able then, because if you were holding too tight to the old ideas, you can't embrace a new idea. You can't find, he said, and your problem isn't that you don't have some good ideas. Your problem is you can't tell the good ideas from the bad ideas. If you'll sit them down, the truth will find its way back over time. It will require an open-mindedness that I've not yet had. But he said the first idea you've got to let go of is the idea that you think you know what just happened. Now, see, I thought when Connie and I, when we were going through that bankruptcy, it felt like we were going broke. But what happened as a result of that is it absolutely changed my marriage relationship. It changed me. I'm like that guy playing poker on TV, you know, that Texas Hold'em that finally got all in. I wasn't holding any chips back. That's when we took a good marriage and it became a relationship that I wouldn't trade for anything. So I thought I was going broke when in fact I was undergoing relationship counseling. You know, things don't look like, I've never had the courage or the wisdom to volunteer for those things which have been most instructive and most helpful in my life. So today I am more and more willing for things to happen to me. You know, AA is not about me having a life where my demands are met. It's about me lessening my demands on life. It's about me being okay with the way things are. You know, we talk a lot about a day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't drink a day at a time. But the fact is, today's the day. Today's the day that I want to have a good day. And for me to have a good day today, I've got to be okay with this set of circumstances, with me as I am, you as you are, and the circumstances of this day as they are. I got to find a way to be okay right now. Joe, about 5 years ago, I was moving. I'd moved back to Nashville in 1997, and Frank became my sponsor again. But I continued to talk with Joe weekly, and Frank died about a year and a half ago. And I had the privilege of being in the hotel room, in the hospital room with he and his wife and his two daughters and three other people that he sponsored when they turned the respirator off. And I had a chance to be there and hold him and literally be kissing him on the forehead when he took his last breath. And while it was sad for a moment, the truth is it was a privilege to be able to be a part of that. And that's what he and Joe and others in AA had done for me. But Joe introduced me to how to live a principled life. My brother and I and a couple other guys we work with were moving into an office building about 5 years ago. We bought a little office building. We were moving our business into it. We were buying some furniture. We decided this is a good time to buy some furniture for our homes and bill it through the company and receive the tax advantages that come with that. And I'm running it by Joe. Doesn't seem like a big deal to me. You know, I'm only, 15 years sober at the time. I'm running it by Joe, and he said, Steve, I don't think I would do it, he never has told me what to do, but he said, I don't think I would do it. And I said, well, Joe, I know it sounds a little bit like tax fraud, he said, no, Steve, it is tax fraud. Now, that's that subtle distinction can elude me sometimes. I'm the type of guy that says, oh, it's kind of like a first cousin to tax fraud, But what you do for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is help me see the truth and then live my life based on that truth rather than some version that's clouded through my fear or my pride or any of those things. We moved back to Nashville in 1997, and I got with that home group. I met some people that continue to change my life, that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous that make me want to be a better man. One of those was a man named Mo H. Mo passed away now close to 5 years ago. Every time that Mo shared, he would share the verse to a poem. And when I first heard him do that over 10 years ago, I knew that the verse to that poem summed up my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous as succinctly as anything that anyone has ever said to me here, certainly more so than I've done in the hour that I've talked. So for the next couple of minutes, I want to do the last thing that I think or the next thing that I believe our book suggests I do. It also says that each of us in his own language and from his own point of view talks about how he established a relationship with God. Because I do believe that it's through a power greater than myself that I'm sober today because lack of power is my dilemma. And I didn't seem to be able to make the necessary changes either in my behavior, in my drinking, or the way I felt on self-knowledge alone. But when I got to AA, I don't know that I was atheist or agnostic, but I was at a minimum apathetic. I was uninvested in anything to do with God or higher power, and all the words spiritual experience and prayer and God all made me uncomfortable. When we would get together at the end of the meeting and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer, I would step back from the circle. I would not hold hands, and I would stare at the ceiling. I did this for a while, and finally a guy named Mike came up to me one day, and he said, "Steve, what's that all about, buddy? What's going on there?" And with all the earnestness I could muster, and I'm in it, I said, "Mike, I just don't know what I believe. I don't believe this. I'm not on board, and I don't want to be a hypocrite. I can't make myself do something I don't believe." And he said, "Steve," this guy had heard me share quite a bit. He knew a lot about me. He had heard some confessional type fifth step I'd done with him. And he said, "Steve, I got some good news for you and some bad news for you." And I felt a little condescended too, but I said, "Mike, put it on me. What's the bad news?" He said, "The bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems." He said, "You have broken every vow you've made to the people that you love most. Now you draw the line at hypocrisy, you know." I said, "What's the good news, Mike?" He said, "The good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I tell you, I'm as pleased about that today as I've ever been. It's as important to me today because I'm going to tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where we espouse perfect ideals, where we say that we're going to cut that, we're going to aim for perfection but settle for patient improvement, where we say right in how it works that we're going to come nowhere near perfect adherence to these principles. So there are times that I'm going to look like a hypocrite, and there are times that I'm going to sound like a hypocrite. And what's worse, there are times that I'm going to be a hypocrite. I'm not going to mean to. It's not going to be malicious, but it's going to happen. I'm going to say one thing and do another. But you don't kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for failing to reach perfection. You don't kick me out for falling down. This is where you help me up. This is where we help each other grow together. This is where, you know, I need to remember that when I'm at the, at my home group and the treatment center bus pulls up and I go, "Oh, they're going to drink all our coffee and take all our chairs and, you know." Just when I thought I had this thing where I wanted it, you know, a newcomer. And we can't expect people to show up knowing the rules. We need to reach out and help that person. And I want to remember to be a person that does that in my home group. And sometimes I'm not. So I needed to find this power. And over the years, it took me a while, but right now where I'm at, and this is an old, I'm prepared for my idea to change any time. But what works for me today is what I found in We Agnostics, and it says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. So I've quit trying to define or comprehend that power. That's freed up some time for me. I've given that up. And it says deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In fact, in the last analysis, it is only there that the great reality may be found. So that's my last analysis. So I'm not searching anymore. I'm not analyzing anymore. It goes on to say that careful now, Steve, that may be obstructed by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. And I believe pomp is a reemergence of self and pride and ego. I think that worship of other things seem to be any and all of those things that I place above that relationship with that power, my sobriety in you. And I think that calamity can be as real as what happened to those young people here in that drunk driving accident the other day. Or it can be financial ruin. Or it can be disease. Or I can get home tomorrow night and the cable can be out on my TV and I can raise that to the level of calamity. Because calamity is anything, again, that I've decided can't be happening to me. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am prepared for more and more things to happen to me and it be okay. So I think that's what the 12 steps do, is help remove those things that are obstructing me. Alcoholics Anonymous is not where I become a new person, I don't believe. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is where I become the person I really am. I think the authentic me gets uncovered when those defects of character begin to get pushed out of the way a little bit, when the swelling goes down on those some and the real me can emerge. So then it goes on to say, as I draw near to him, he will disclose himself to me. And the way I draw near to him is to draw near to you. And when my friend Mo came down with cancer a few years ago, and my friend Jerry and I went to breakfast with him, as it turns out, just about 6 weeks before he passed away. And we knew it was the last time that we would probably be together. And I said, Mo, would you mind if, when I get a chance to share my story, that I close with that poem that you have always used? I said, because it'll help me honor you. In the truest sense of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will help me pass on what you have given to me. And he said, you know, Steve, he was a little embarrassed, you know, but he was clearly pleased. And he said, if you think it'll help another drunk. Because that's all he cared about. If Frank introduced me to the literature and the message of recovery in the big book, and Joe introduced me to the third legacy and to how to apply these principles, Mo loved Alcoholics Anonymous and the alcoholic, wet or dry, as much as anybody I ever met. And he's the guy at that meeting that, when that perennial slipper would come back in and I act busy like I'm fixing some coffee or looking down, or, oh, not me again, you look up and Mo is running to him and giving him a kiss. He was a kisser, and he said, man, we're glad you're back. I'm so glad you're back. And I'd look at that and know that I want to be a better man, and I want to be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of every one of Mo's talks, he would share what has become my experience in AA. And it was simply, I sought my God I could not see. And I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it is through you letting me be a part of your life, through me letting you participate in my life, that disconnection, what brings me together with you now is that God within, the God within me and the God within you, however anyone wants to conceive of that God. And I'm so glad that you've allowed me that opportunity. I appreciate your patience and let me say what I needed to say tonight. And I'm better off for having said it than you are from having heard it. I know that. But thanks again. Good night.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you very much. Get my leg up like a girl.